7. So you can turn to that in your Bible. It will be on the screen behind me, so you can read along if you don't have a Bible. Please turn there. Hear the word of the Lord. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn." But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes. Anything more than this comes from evil.
Good morning. Let me dismiss the children into the rear and hear from the Lord. My name is Nathan. It's not a chance to meet you. What a gift it is to open up the Bible and just be able to look at it, read it, think about it, and apply it to our lives. That's what we're going to do. Real simple. We're going to open up these passages and think about them. So let me pray before we do that. Father, thank you for your word. We're grateful for Jesus Christ. Thank you that his word is so clear. God, help us to pay attention. In 1979, the great musician Billy Joel wrote a song. It's called Honesty. And just listen to its sobering lyrics. He says, the song Honesty, the song, he says, if you search for tenderness, it isn't hard to find. You can have the love you need to live if you look for truthfulness. You might just as well be blind. It seems, oh, it always seems to be so hard to give. Honesty is such a lonely word. Everyone is so untrue. Honesty is hardly ever heard, and mostly what I need from you. I can always find someone to say they sympathize if I wear my heart out on my sleeve, but I don't want some pretty face to tell me pretty lies. All I want is someone to believe. Honesty is such a lonely word. Everyone is so untrue. Such a sad and somber song that is ironically quite true, isn't it? Honesty is hardly ever heard, it seems. And we live here in Washington, D.C., a city that every poll in America will tell you is the most dishonest city in the country. Well, Billy Joel says something else there in that song that I think is important to draw out regarding honesty. He says that you can have the love you need to live if you just add truthfulness. I believe Billy Joel is more right than he probably knew when he wrote those words. See, what we're going to see this morning as we continue in looking at Jesus' words on the Sermon on the Mount is those two things that Billy Joel wrote about. That honesty is a lonely word, and that everyone often is so untrue. And so it provides for us, Restoration Church, a great opportunity to be salt and light as a community that's honest. And secondly, honesty is what we mostly need. We can have the love we need to live if we just had truthfulness. That's what we're going to see. Jesus is going to confront us regarding our integrity. So put your seatbelt on, because this one's going to hurt. Jesus is always, one of the many things I love about Jesus, one of the many things I love about him is he's always an equal opportunity offender. And he is going to get us all, I think, this morning as we look at this passage. So before we jump in, just a reminder of where we have been. Jesus is helping us see the bottom of the law that had been given to God's people. So the religious teachers of the day had tried to narrow God's ways in order to make them more manageable. So in doing so, many thought of themselves much more righteous than they actually were, because they had narrowed those laws, made them more manageable. So in this sermon,
Jesus is exposing the fact that we are all much more unrighteous than we actually realize. And so he's doing that so as to press the point of the reason for which he came, so that they would see the need. They would see the righteousness that they do not have, so that then they would reach for righteousness that they could attain through Christ. So take a look there again at verse 33 that Jeremy read there before in Matthew 5, 33. You see there, Jesus is paraphrasing the teaching of the law that had been handed down. It's no sort of one thing that was in the law. He's kind of paraphrasing a few things that have been taught in the Old Testament, the First Testament. One of those commands that he probably paraphrased was the third commandment of Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, which says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." Another one he probably was paraphrasing is Leviticus 19, 12, "You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God." Probably another one, Numbers 30, verse 2, "If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." And so what does Jesus think about all these ways that the religious teachers have sort of managed to sort of communicate these laws and how they have been dealing with them? How does he communicate? What does Jesus think about this? Well, you see his response there in verse 34, down to verse 36 of chapter 5. "But I say, you do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God," and on down he goes. We'll see that more in just a minute. And it's a curious response from Jesus, isn't it? Curious response. At first, it appears as though Jesus is contradicting the Bible. Did we just read in Numbers chapter 30, verse 2, that it allows for oaths? And we find time and again in verses like Hebrews chapter 6, where it says very clearly that God is openly taking an oath. So to begin with, let me sort of address those two questions. Oaths as they relate to man, oaths as they relate to God. So to begin with, as it relates to God's word relating to oaths by men, what we find in Scripture is the same thing we found in the previous passage we looked at last week regarding divorce. Oaths were a concession that were meant to curb sin. So God's design for marriage, as we saw last week, from the beginning was no divorce. Divorce, in those very narrow circumstances, was a concession, but it never was supposed to be that way, and it still isn't. Likewise, God's laws regarding oaths was not the intention of His creation. So before sin entered into the world, there was no need of oaths. Remember, it was the great deceiver that twisted God's words to Adam and Eve. So before sin entered into the world, there's no need of oaths. So the prescription for how oaths or vows were to be administered was a concession to try to curb, to try to slow down or give confidence to sinful dishonesty that had become so apparent in the world in which those people lived. So that's why they're there. As it relates to God Himself making oaths, well, His oaths were not and are not of the same nature as ours. Why is that? Well, because He is swearing to Himself, the highest authority, the perfect authority that has never been dishonest, in order to give confidence to mankind who has largely only known dishonesty. So God's truthfulness was never in doubt as opposed to our own. So again, it was a concession to build our confidence in His truthfulness based upon His perfections. So when Jesus says, "Do not take an oath at all," He is speaking to mankind, and like divorce, He's helping them see that there was a concession, but there never was meant for there to be an intention of having these types of oaths even be made. So let me go ahead and answer another question that maybe you have. Is Jesus laying down a law that says we can never swear an oath? Never swear, never make a promise? I'm mindful of the fact that some of you have stood in a court of law and you put your name in a Bible and you said, "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God," right? I'm mindful that there are some here from the military that have sworn to defend our country. I know that there are married couples in the room. Our brother Ben is getting married today. He's going to stand and make oaths. He's going to make vows. Is that wrong? Should Ben not do that today? Maybe. Sorry, Ben. But my answer is no. I think there is room. That's not exactly what Jesus is doing. He's not laying down His law. He's trying to make a point. Matthew chapter 26, verse 63, as Jesus, He stands in a court. And court of Caiaphas, the high priest, Jesus was asked to swear. He was asked to make an oath if he was truly the Son of God. And Jesus' response was not to say that he didn't believe people should take oaths. He didn't just not answer the question. He actually answered the question. He said, "You have said so." We also find in numerous places where it is positively represented that the people of God take vows, places like Romans chapter 1, verse 9, where Paul says, "God is my witness." Well, then what does Jesus mean by saying, "Do not take an oath at all"? Well, I think he's speaking firmly to make a point. He's speaking firmly to make a point. Same way that we might say to one another, "Never drive down Wisconsin Avenue at 5:30. Right? Sort of like that. Or something like we would say, "Listen, never talk about politics from the pulpit." Right? Sort of how they did. Now, we don't mean by that that you should never drive down Wisconsin Avenue, that you should never talk about politics. No, what we're doing is we're trying to heighten, right, the importance of what's going on. Something that has become very flippant, we're not thinking highly about. I think that's the way in which Jesus is talking. And so that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to curb the flippant approach that people had towards those. He's calling people to a greater lifestyle of honesty that doesn't need those at all. So let's take a harder look at what Jesus is calling us to. He says, don't take an oath. And then notice two things as we walk through in verse 34 to 36. I want you to notice two things as we walk through. Look what he does. You're going to see two things. Notice he's going to scale them. Jesus is. He's going to scale them. He's going to start with heaven. He's going to go down to earth, down to Jerusalem, down to hair, if you have any. Right. And then also the second thing that you'll notice as we walk through, I want you to notice as he talks about these things, he's addressing the correction. He's correcting people's understanding of ownership. He's helping them see that they actually don't own those things they're swearing on. So now having some thought about that, let's see how he does this. He says, don't take an oath by heaven, for it is the throne of God. Don't take an oath by earth, for it is his footstool. Don't take an oath by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And don't take an oath by your own head. You can't make it change of color. Yeah. So what appears to have been happening in those days is that people's integrity was not strong enough to vouch for their own actions. And so they needed something more to swear upon in order to get that thing that they wanted. They needed to swear in order to receive what they had wanted. Their lives were not enough. Their word was not enough. And don't we do the same thing? All of us. Don't we do the same? See, it's not enough to tell our spouse, "I'll go to the grocery store." Well, we have to say, because I forget or just don't want whatever. "I promise this time I'll go to the grocery store." Right? Or we say things like this. It's not enough for us to tell a friend, "Listen, I'm going to come to church." So, like, "I promise this time, I swear this time I'm going to show up to church on time." Right? We do the same thing. So, since their word wasn't enough, they needed to swear on something as a kind of collateral to make their point, to get that thing they wanted. So, they knew they couldn't swear on the name of God and have it be false. We already saw that from the law. So, they figured they could swear on something that was religious. And then if they didn't fulfill the vow, it might not be so bad since they didn't, you know, swear on the name of God. Which, of course, was wrong. So they would say, "Listen, I swear on the city of Jerusalem that I'll have your donkey back this afternoon." That's sort of how they, maybe something they said, for heaven's sake, "I didn't drink too much wine last night." Maybe that's what they said. And we, again, do the same thing. We only are a bit less reverent. We don't make vows on holy things, but much more manageable things. "On my grave, I will return that book." Right? We'll say things like that. "I promise I pay you back. If I don't pay you back, I'll do your laundry for a week." Right? We do this. So what Jesus seems to be exposing is that we have no right to swear upon things that we do not have control over. We do not have control over. That's what I take him to mean when he talks about the different things that they shouldn't take an oath on heaven. Don't take an oath on heaven because it's the throne of God. In other words, it's on your throne. Don't take an oath on earth because it's God's footstool. It's not your footstool. It's not mine. It's his. Don't take an oath on Jerusalem because it's the city of the great king. It's God's king. You're not the king. Or even on your own head because you can't even control the colors of hair on your head. Unless you go get Just for Men and use a condom or something to change it. But even that, you know, goes and goes away. can't control any of these things. So there is no sphere by which the sovereign God does not rule. And so they have no right to swear upon something that they cannot control, since God is the sovereign God that rules over all. So I think it'd be good for us to pause here before we begin to apply truthfulness and think about this point that Jesus is making. Think about this point of God's sovereignty, his rule over the world. Have you noticed that we cannot control the weather? Have you noticed that we cannot control the locations and the realities of beaches and mountains? And try as we may to try and eat healthy and exercise, we cannot control the inevitable reality that one day we will all die. Difficult though it is for us to consider, God is sovereign over the universe. From the tiniest little microorganism to the clouds in the sky, they're all put together to sing the glory of his praise. For his good and our, and his good and his glory alone. And so, this is hard for us, right? This idea of God's sovereignty. So we are Google calendar loving people, right? We are smartphone addicted people. We are air conditioned, arrogant Westerners that are put off by a car pulling up sooner than we had hoped. And so we have a hard time coming to the grips with the fact that God is sovereignly ruling over all things, because we're not, and we're unhappy when people try to take away that power that we think we have from us. So what we find here, friends, is the reality is, while we don't want to see God's sovereignty, his rule over the universe, we often don't want to believe it. We don't want to see it. We don't want to believe it. Because we like to think that we are governing our own lives. We don't want to give him up control. All of us struggle with this. All of us do. And I'll ask you one question to drive that point home, to make it clear that you think you control and God's really not that much in control of your life. One question. You ready? How's your prayer life? Ouch. See, if we really were relying on the reality of God sovereignly reigning over the universe, we would be much more apt to pray, wouldn't we? But as it is, we don't pray, at least not in a meaningful and regular sense, because at the bottom of it, we think we have a pretty good handle of our lives. And Jesus is telling us, don't count on your plans, because God rules from the heavens. The earth is the place to rest his foot. Our cities are governed by his king, and every strand of hair is accounted for in the mind of God. And guess what, friend? That's just the way that you want it to be. Whether you decide you didn't want it to be that way, then you do actually, at the base of it, you really do want it to be that way. How is it I know that? Because if you were getting control of your life, it wouldn't go so well. And there's this movie, one of my favorite movies, called It's a Wonderful Life. It's a movie about a guy who found out what it was like to see what his life would be like if he wasn't born. So the title of your movie, if you were given control of your life, would be It's a Terrible Life. Because you would find out that you actually, if you were given total sovereignty over your own life, it would not go well. We need God to control. So though it seems like the universe is even spinning out of control, Christ affirms here that God rules over it, and as well he should, since he is its maker and its sustainer. And since he rules over it all, we would be fools to swear or take oaths in what we cannot control. So, you then ask the question, which is a very good one. Okay, Nathan, what can I control? What can I control? Well, friend, you can control your own personal integrity. You can't control heaven, you can't control earth, you can't control Washington, D.C., but you can't control your personal integrity. Take a look there at verse 37. Chapter 5, verse 37, it says, let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. We could be rendered, anything more than this comes from the evil one. Simply yes or no. James chapter 5, verse 12, he takes the cue from this teaching, says something similar, James 5, 12. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other, but let your yes be yes or your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. So what Jesus is saying here is that there is nothing that you can swear upon that you can use as collateral to control anything that you may want or need. What you can control all is your personal integrity. And if you have integrity, you don't need to swear upon anything at all because your word is your bond. See, the only reason that or even we need to make promises or swear oaths is because there is a lack of integrity that we need to borrow some sort of capital by because we're seemingly untrustworthy. So we're trying to swear upon other things to sort of use it as collateral to get what we want, if this should not be. You'll recall, right, that oaths were a concession to a fallen world. And so those who have a righteousness that exceeds the scribes and the Pharisees needn't have to make vows or oaths or promises. Their lives are the collateral. The testimony, the faithfulness of their integrity. So the righteous man or the woman who is governed by the gospel of Christ, who lives for the kingdom of heaven and not the kingdom of man, does not need to borrow collateral to secure something. They have been reconciled to God, who is the way, the life, and the what? Truth. Truth have been brought back to him. So there is a temptation to deceive. There is no temptation to deceive for the Christian because their destiny has already been marked. They are bound for heaven. God is their treasure, and this world cannot offer them anything if it entails deception. That is the resident of the kingdom of heaven. They live by conviction, not by passion. Their yeses are their yeses, their noes are their noes. If anything needs to be added, it only reveals deception. And is it the evil one known as the deceiver? Truthfulness, friends, truthfulness. Truthfulness, honesty, integrity is the steel that holds up the Christian. Integrity is the platform by which the pastor can stand upon and deliver the truth. Integrity is the soil that the church of Jesus Christ walks upon because they refuse to walk any other path because they know that their Lord didn't walk any other path. Listen to Proverbs chapter 19. Referencing integrity, the fullness of truth. Proverbs 19:1. Better is a poor person who walks in his integrity than one who is crooked in speech and is a fool. Proverbs 28:6. Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a rich man who is crooked in his ways. Proverbs 10:9. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but he who makes his ways crooked will be found out. Integrity, folks, is being full of the truth and honesty no matter the cost. And so Christ is saying that the residents of the kingdom are men and women whose word, whose lives are enough. And yet we languish, don't we, brothers and sisters? Those that know us best know our simple yeses and noes are enough. We are even mindful of God. He knows of us that our simple yeses and noes are not enough. God himself knows this. How many times have we sworn, this will be the year for Jesus? Right? How many times have we said, never again will I look at porn? How many times have we decided to be much more disciplined in time after time we fail? So we like to believe that we aren't quite as dishonest as we actually are. We like to believe we're actually full of integrity. And yet how many times do we stretch the truth just enough to get what we want? We tell people we've traveled the world. That includes a 2-hour layover in Frankfurt, Germany, a week-long vacation with our parents in the Bahamas when we were 10. I'm 5'8", 165 pounds. Turns into, I'm 5'9", 160. A 2.97 GPA turns into a much more pleasurable 3.0. Just enough. Instead of saying you don't know when asked the question, you try and say just enough to solidify their confidence in you and them seeking input out of you, even though you don't know anything about it. Or a common thing that I found in Washington, D.C., we exaggerate either where we work or what we do at work so that others will find us more powerful, more admirable, and more accomplished. I've noticed this common thing when we sign our emails with all the things and all the proficiencies that we have accomplished and what we will do in the world. And if we don't stress the truth, we subtract the truth by leaving pieces of the story out. spending a large amount of money on a shopping spree, we tell our Christian friends, "Oh, I just spent a few bucks at the store." Or after drinking four or five, maybe six beers, you tell your accountability partner, "Oh, I just had a couple beers." Or oftentimes we try to rationalize things, don't we? "So I know I got a speeding ticket, but listen, I was just trying to get my brother. I really need to get there for him. I need to get to that thing on time." Or we say, "My neighbors, you know, my neighbors, they pay for the wireless account. So if somebody's paying for it, so I don't really need to pay for it. It was better for me to lie to my spouse because, you know, it would have hurt them if I just told them the truth." So we try to rationalize our dishonesty, our sin. And why is it we do this? Why do we play these games? Why are we so dishonest? Because we're cowards. We're fearful of telling the truth. We're afraid to speak the truth plainly because of the ramifications that may come by telling the truth. Something we want or need may get taken away from us, or it may not come to us at all if we actually speak the truth. So we cower in fear and we lie so as to get what we really want. But why do we want those things that we're fearful to tell? Why is it why do we want those things we're afraid we might not get if we tell the truth? Why? Why do we want those things? Well, I think it's because we want the praise of man. We're cowards to tell the truth because we want to attain the praise of man in various ways, shapes, and forms. We want others to think highly of us. If we tell the truth, we might lose the praise of people. We want them to think that we're smart, that we're funny, that we're attractive, that we're powerful. We want the world to think that we are people of distinction. And why do we do that? Why do we do that? Why we are cowards because we long for the praise of man. But why do we want the praise of man? I think it's because we all want to be accepted. We want to be accepted by a fellow man. See, if I tell my neighbor over coffee that Christ, if they don't know Christ, then they will spend eternity in hell. Either they're going to think I'm an idiot for believing in God, or they're going to think I'm very narrow-minded. And so I don't tell them that, because I don't want them to think those things about me. So if they think that I'm an idiot or closed-minded, they're not going to accept me. They're going to reject me. I don't want them to reject me. I want them to accept me. If they accept me, they'll praise me. They'll think much of me. I want them to think that I'm smart, that I'm funny, whatever. Why do I want to be accepted? So I can receive their praise? Yeah, I think that's part of it, but that's not all. The reason why we want to be accepted and be praised is because we don't want to be alone. We don't want to be alone. See, this gets at the deepest root of why we aren't truthful and why we distort the truth and not have our lives reflect these yeses and yeses and noes. We want the praise of our fellow man because we want to be accepted. We want to be accepted because we don't want to be alone. And here it is. We don't want to be alone because we want to be loved. We want to be loved. At the root of our dishonesty is a yearning to be loved. Do you remember that line in Billy Joel's song? "You can have the love you need to live. Truthfulness." So this makes sense why Joel would have connected honesty to loneliness. Honesty is such a lovely word because honesty is such a lonely word because people are scared to be alone and be unloved. And it's right here, friends, where the gospel speaks so clearly. Speaks clearly and distinctly, the gospel does, from the rest of the world. See, the rest of the world will tell you to tell them lies in order to gain their acceptance of the world. But Jesus Christ would have you to be honest to gain his acceptance. Everything. He doesn't need you to clean up your act before you come to him. He doesn't need you to dress a certain way, talk a certain way. He doesn't even need you to work at a certain job or any sort of fancy title. He wants you to be honest, Jesus does, about everything. Everything. Even that thing you're thinking about right now, yes, even that. He wants you to be honest about exactly what he needs from you. So what you think that you will cause, what you think will cause Jesus to not love you, actually, when you're honest with him about it, only serves to usher you more into his grace, more into his love. There's nobody like him. There's nobody like Jesus. He wants you to confess your wrongs, your failures, your doubts, your fears, and he wants you to place them at the foot of the cross. For it is there that he died to pay for all of those sins and rose to give you life. And it is here where heaven and earth come together in the person and work of Jesus Christ that you can find the love and acceptance that you are so desperately trying to find in the world. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the only place to find where love and mercy meet. And so you can stop the charade, friend. You can even stop the charade with God and be honest with him. And turn away from your sin. Look to Jesus, receive his love, his acceptance, live in the freedom of letting your yes be your yes and your no be your no. And part of you are saying, some of you, that seems a little too good to be true, Nathan. I mean, my own friend, that guy or that gal that I'm interested in, even they won't accept me. How is the God of the universe going to accept me if I'm honest? This friend is the God of heaven. This is the God of heaven. That's what he offers to all those that trust in the work of Christ, an unparalleled love and acceptance in the face of honesty. Isn't it strange that so many people have difficulty confessing their sin to God? When he's made provision for their sin, provision for their dishonesty in the work of Christ, that they might be ushered into that love and acceptance. And so I ask you the question this morning. What happens to a man or woman who can finally begin to live in some of this truth of getting honest with God in experiencing that love and acceptance from God as they trust in the work of Christ? What happens to somebody if they actually do this, if they get honest? But what might happen to a man or woman who finally begin to get honest with God about their sin and learn to live in the love and acceptance of God as they trust in the work of Christ? They feel his forgiveness. I think there's no question what would happen. No question. Having experienced the love and acceptance of the living God in the gospel, they would then move out into the world full. Full. Full of the love of God. Full of the acceptance of God. And since they would be full, there would be no place to hold on to those hurtful words. You're overweight. You're not pretty. You're not smart. You're a failure. You're not good enough. You see, since there was no room for those words, they could then love and accept those who were their enemies, just as Christ loved and accepted them, since they were his enemy. They would then gather this person that is filled with love of God and acceptance of God, having been reconciled through our honesty, through a confession. They would then gather with other men and women who have experienced the same thing. And entire communities would begin to spring up to sing of the splendor of his praise. And they wouldn't need to posture churches. They wouldn't need to posture with one another. They wouldn't need to measure up against one another. They could live together in the freedom of the gospel that liberated them from the lies of the world. And they would then be brought together in the love and acceptance as the people of God, and they would rejoice in it. And they would invite others into that. Aren't redeemed. They would invite others into that same love and acceptance that they have come to know. This is what happens, friends, when we get honest with God and with each other. This is how we come to have our yeses be our yeses and our noes. You see, friends, I know I can give you five things to do this week. Here's five ways to go and have your yeses be your yeses and your noes be your noes. Here's five ways to go be honest this week. And that would be helpful. Maybe it was, I think, wrong. But listen, I know that in a room full of maybe 120 people, maybe some of you would do three of them by Thursday. See, the resources that are needed to build a life of integrity are not found from within. They're found from without. They're found in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. The gospel is the only thing that will give you the confidence to be honest no matter what may come to you. even though he had the praise of the people. And he intentionally divided them.
I mean, I love that story in John 6, after he feeds the 5,000 and thousands, throngs are coming around him. And he says things like,
you got to eat my blood. You got to drink my blood and eat my body. You're going to get in. This dude's crazy. I'm out.
Yep. And he turns around to the disciples and says, you got to leave too?
You have the words of eternal life, Peter says.
He had the crowd, he had everybody, and he intentionally spoke in words of honesty. That did not sway him. His teaching was so powerful that he could hold the attention of the most uninterested, and yet he never used that to build for himself greater comfort. In fact, his radical commitment to truthfulness and honesty was the very thing that brought him pain and abandonment. He was so committed to being his yeses and his noes and noes. He was so committed to integrity. He was so committed to truth-telling, speaking the truth in love. He was so committed to it that it brought him, and he knew it, pain and abandonment by those that were closest to him. He never lied.
Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5:22, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. He was so committed to truthfulness that he was willing to be abandoned and received hate. Why? So that we wouldn't have to. So that we wouldn't have to.
So that we wouldn't have to. So that we could experience love and acceptance. He went into the fray of being unaccepted, of being hated, so that we wouldn't have to. Ever again, for eternity. And how was he able to do this? Jesus. It's the same truth I'm telling you. How was he able to enter in that fray and be unaccepted and feel not like he's being loved? Because he was so full of the love of the Father. What you will, God, whatever you want, I don't want to do this, but I love you, and I'm going to walk this path if that means I still get with you. Why is he so sad on the cross? And he screams, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because he's not feeling loved. And that's the thing that made him able to do it. But he did it so that we could be in the love and acceptance of God. So that having been reconciled to him, known that love and forgiveness, we can be honest with him, having been forgiven, and move out into the world and be honest, reflecting the truthfulness of God. He did it to make it possible for us to do it. And he did it because he wanted us to know love and know acceptance. John 17:26. I have made known to them your name. This is Jesus speaking to the Father. And I will continue to make it known that the love with which you have loved me, most astounding verse in the entire Bible, the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. God would love us the same way he loves his Son? Yes. He would accept us the same way he would his Son? Yes. Can you see why we call this good news? This is good news because it's not my account. I'll lie today. I don't mean to, but I probably will. But at the end of it, I'll say, no, it's Jesus, his righteousness. I get in because of him. And so I got to hold on to him every single day. And I'm so full of the love of the Son, so full of the love of the Father, so full of the love of the Spirit, I can move and be honest with the world. I don't need to posture. If they reject me, they reject Jesus. So what? I mean, I don't know what you mean. But I'm full of the love of the Father. I'm full of the love of the Son. I don't need their acceptance. I don't need to be debilitated by what they might think of me. I can be free. Been loved and accepted by the Father to be honest and live and move and have my being. And so, friends, walk away from dishonesty. Walk away from deceit. Live in the love and acceptance of the Father and go and live a life that doesn't need to swear because it's built upon the one who is the truth, Christ the Lord. And when you are slandered, as Peter says, when you are slandered for the truth, may they see your good behavior in Christ and be put to shame. Jesus, when he was being held accountable in the court, do you remember they kept trying to accuse him of things? And do you remember none of them stuck? Because he was always truthful. Let that be your life. Let
acceptance of God as you trust in the gospel and are truthful. And so, friends, let me encourage you. This is the sort of to-do portion other than trusting Christ. If you're convicted by ways that you've been dishonest, this week you will have the opportunity in community group to confess those sins one to another. Just do that. And brothers and sisters that are in those groups, encourage them with the love and forgiveness of Christ. If there's a phone call that needs to be had today, when you walk out of here realizing that you've lied, you've been dishonest with somebody, make that call. If you have some sort of conversation that needs to be had here right after church because of something you said, you've not been reflecting honestly,